from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. The latest on health and healing, and some new information about our national health care program. Remember the one that was promoted that it would do so much for so many people? But I went through it in great detail, and I found that it only really did a lot for those people who wrote it. Well, new information on that today. My guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Philip Snacken. He has written a very important work called Psychiatry Land, The Promise of Illusions Through Big Pharma and Psychiatry, and how these illusions are kept alive. I will have a lot of questions for him concerning the legitimacy of psychiatry, his board-certified profession, and whether or not he can justify that it's a legitimate healing science. It may be legitimate as an art in psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, but in psychopharmacology, he'll have to prove it to me because the evidence is simply not there. A comprehensive commentary today, and this is directed towards those individuals in this audience, as well as the larger audiences of people listening on radio or watching television who believe that whatever we do in the United States, in the name of freedom and democracy and peace, we should stop for a moment and reexamine and see who really benefits at what cost. And then wrapping around the idea that we are sponsoring every day with our purchases, what we watch, what we drink, what we eat, we're globalization. And how does that impact other people? Do we care? Should we care in a society that we've been promoting, or a lot of people have been promoting? It's really irrelevant. I remember once on 60 Minutes watching an interview with George Soros, and Soros was one of the first of a group of individuals who were super powerful and wealthy because they used their money for political gain, at least gaining in the areas they believed in. But how he made his money, he said, was not a question that he considered important. And yet he made his money in derivatives, and also when it came to trading in currencies and shorting those currencies. So hundreds of millions of people were adversely affected, the quality of their life. So what does it mean when you don't care how you make your money, even if it's legal, but what if it's not moral? So high noon for the Imperium. American Empire in the Future, Professor Paul Atwood. You won't want to miss that commentary. I'll have my own insights as well, as I've written extensively on this. So we have a full program, and I will be opening up our calls on our talkback segment so you can call in and share your points of view. Now, my perspective, if you've been listening for any period of time, is that we really need a completely independent group of individuals with food science and nutritional biochemistry and environmental chemistry and behavioral chemistry, behavioral sciences, to work together to find out how can we maximize a person's life and health. We have these people. The science is certainly there. Many people, tens of millions of Americans, are making healthy choices, and the outcome after years is that they're not suffering anywhere near the incidence of disease as the average person. Now, that's the first step in healthcare. You actually determine what is health, and then you provide steps that a person can take. If they're too complicated, people are not going to take them. But they should also have some education behind them. So you could have people talk about, here's what I did when I used to have arthritis or high blood pressure, and I started walking, and I started doing this, and eating differently, and I gave up this. That's the best education there is. But it can't have any industry, can't have anyone from the health industry, and can't have anyone from the disease industry, the pharmaceutical industry, participating in it. Otherwise, then it's biased. Instead, what we have is we have a medical industrial juggernaut. We have a group of people, not many, probably under about 5,000, who literally control everything that we eat and drink, and then how we medicate because of what we've eaten and what we've drank. And then we have even a smaller group of people who determine what a doctor is allowed to do. Now, we have over 900,000 doctors, but they can't automatically just start to treat a patient any way they believe is in the patient's best interest. So we have to deal with these issues. And so when we were told that we have all that taken care of, that we actually have a really good, comprehensive healthcare program, everyone kind of said, good, we're glad about that. Getting people covered who wouldn't be covered, that's good. Covering children who wouldn't be covered, that's really good. But then everything else was in the details, and that's where it's not good. The trouble is we have not had an objective group of nonpartisans sit down and say, let's go through this line by line, and let's look at what is good and what is not good and why. We have done that. And we have seen that, first, who wrote this bill? It wasn't the president. It wasn't his advisors. It was the pharmaceutical industry, the for-profit hospital industry, and the insurance industry. They worked together. They had multiple meetings in the White House with members of Congress. They had thousands of lobbyists, more lobbyists than any other group in Washington. And literally everything they wanted, they got. Then how do you dress this up? How do you sell this to the American public? And that was the next thing, selling it so people would think that they were getting something they actually didn't. So we still have massive numbers of people who are uninsured. And then the idea that you should be forced to pay for something, and if not, you would be penalized. But what if what you're paying for is defective? Would you buy a defective car? No. What if you were forced to buy a defective car? What if you were forced to buy something you know would not serve your interests? Well, in the area of health, I know what I need for my health, and I know if something went wrong with my body, the type of medical care I would want. If I'm going to a dentist, it's going to be a holistic dentist. If I'm going to a physician, it's a holistic physician, one who has the traditional training and background, but then takes a step beyond that and really educates themselves in how they know the body works and how to get it well. All of that is not only not addressed to my advantage, it's actually restricted. So now, what if I have cancer? What if I have what is called a catastrophic illness? The number one cause of bankruptcy for almost 10 years until the housing crisis was health care. Now it's the housing crisis and then health care. This is not addressed. You can still go broke with this new system. Here is the latest on what I consider one of the greatest frauds and PR schemes ever perpetrated on the American public, which should be completely destroyed. Not for the political reasons those on the right would have, but because it is completely self-serving. It just puts hundreds of billions of dollars of profits into the pockets of those who do not deserve it. It puts tens of millions of people's lives at risk. And here's one other thing that no one ever talks about. Please listen to this. This is a takeaway moment. For 5 years, a group of academics in medicine and science, all PhDs and MDs, worked on a report together. And when the report was totally finished, we published it, and we submitted it to every scientific organization, medical magazine, every member of the media. Over 7,000 copies went out. Not a single response. It was called Death by Medicine. Only using their figures, their statistics, but bringing them all together and then doing it disease by disease and then weighing what was good or not good about any particular therapy, we found that virtually all the therapeutic medical models were terrible. From the statin drugs to the chemotherapy agents to the radiation, that we were basing medical models on belief that they worked rather than the science, did they work? We reviewed all the meta-analysis. We looked at who paid for the studies. And without exception, when an industry paid for the study, the results were positive. When the study was done with independent scientists, you had mixed results. Well, so that then was released, and people around the world paid attention to it. I then did a documentary on this called Death by Medicine, which this year, it's still in film festivals. It's the most winning documentary in the history of all documentaries. It's gotten a lot of people interested, but no one in the media touches it. No network, HBO, nobody wants to air this thing. Okay, fine. We understand why. This is the kind of truth they can handle. But one of the figures in here, the accurate figure, is that as little as 600,000, as many as a million Americans every single year are dying because of bad medicine. And one of the highest statistics, well over 200,000 now, is because of medications. So think of it this way, and this is a backdoor way of looking at this. Let's say that we gave every single American the benefit of the best medicine we have. We've already killed 200,000 a year with it. Imagine another couple hundred thousand we would be killing. So not only will we be killing and injuring more people with the accepted current scientifically based medicine that is not scientifically based, but we would put millions of people's lives at risk, tens of millions of people. And I don't know why no one or anyone cannot bring this into a discussion, but it should be. Because literally today, when you go in for many different conditions, you put your life at risk. Now, here's the latest on this. This is from Ethan Huff, Natural News. Quote, the bipartisan congressional committee currently investigating the secret dealings between the Obama administration and Big Pharma prior to the passage of the massive health care overhaul is set to release pertinent new details as to what these dealings entail. In a recent memorandum, the committee unveils the names of some of the key figures involved with these secret negotiations. This is what they're coming up with. Members of the Energy and Commerce Committee, there was a memo, and it explains that how the pharmaceutical manufacturers of America, that's, and by the way, the man who went to a $2 million job running that, right after he got this Medicare bill passed with all the provisions that will give about $1 trillion in profits over 10 years to the pharmaceutical industry and keeps the pharmaceutical industry from having to reduce the price of its drugs to give to Medicare, Medicaid, or VA. This is this lobbying group. And it, quote, colluded with the federal government to make the terms of Obamacare as favorable to drug companies as possible. But it also secretly agreed to abide by certain undisclosed commitments to one another as part of the passage of the bill. Quote, in the coming weeks, the committee intends to show that what the White House agreed to as part of its deal with the pharmaceutical industry and how the full details of this agreement were kept from both the public and the House of Representatives. End quote. Now, this, by the way, is what the members of the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Oversight Investigations had in that memo. Quote, the investigation has determined that the White House, primarily through Office of Health Reform Director Nancy Ann DiPaolo and Jim Messina, with involvement from Chief of Staff Ron Emanuel, was actively engaged in these negotiations with the role of Congress being limited, end quote. Now, a private email sent by Jim Messina, for instance, then Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations to the White House, to the Big Pharma Group, and its lobbyists back on January 15, 2010, exposed the fact that the White House made a, quote, secret deal with this group. That means Big Pharma. And they wrote that, quote, part of it was, quote, something that wasn't part of our deal, which had upset the White House at the time. What do you mean? Part of a deal? What deal? Secret dealings? And then they found out that they had all these meetings, all the meetings that the American public never knew about. And yet at the time when they had public hearings on different parts of the Obamacare, I sent my curriculum vitae and asked, could I be there as a spokesperson, as a scientist, as an advocate, as a professor, as someone who has a background. I was denied. But virtually every single other person who is a progressive in science or public issues involving health was denied. We were all denied. But every one of the people who was selected to be the public face of debate were all either corporate Democrat supporters or corporate Republican supporters. So once again, what they did is they simply brought in all the people that would support them to give evidence so that the media reported on who testified about what. And well, that would be like watching Juan Williams and a couple of these other individuals who are corporate Democrats debate a corporate Republican, it's twiddly-dee-twiddly-do. It has nothing to do with getting to the real truth of anything. So I just want this audience to know we finally have the memos to show that we were lied to, we were manipulated, and this is a major issue. There's virtually nothing now, nothing I would believe or trust out of Washington from any agency, from any politician, because I see just what a cesspool it is. And we all know that, don't we? Unless you're part of the cesspool or benefit from it, or you're one of the people that receives money to continue doing research that means nothing that we will never benefit from. You're in that loop, the loop that will last you a lifetime. As long as you are the obedient person, then never question the absurdity of almost everything our government does, you'll get rewarded. Challenge it, and suddenly you're Chris Hedges, you're Noam Chomsky, you're out of the loop. And to be condemned, ridiculed, put on a terrorist watch list, the media never inviting you. Seven foods that will naturally cleanse your liver. And this is important because a lot of times I'm asked, if I want to detoxify and I don't have much money and I want to do it right, what do I do? Okay, so here are some things that you can use that could make a difference. First and foremost, I believe that green leafy vegetables are crucial, but you have to dilute the juices. I'm going to suggest 6 juices a day using celery and cucumber and apple as your base, but then you can spike it. You could put in some collard greens and Swiss chard and arugula and watercress and parsley. All those are great also. You can throw in some wheatgrass juice into that. So that will help as the major cleanser. Then green tea, white tea, oolong tea, they're loaded with what are called catechins, C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N-S. That's a very powerful antioxidant, and there are hundreds of studies showing that it benefits the liver, especially helping with fatty liver, and so it detoxifies the liver. 3 a day. Then grapefruit and lemon together spike with vitamin C. I'm going to suggest 2 grapefruits and 2 lemons juiced, and then put in maybe 2 or 3,000 milligrams of buffered vitamin C. Rich in enzymes, and that really makes a difference, the flavonoids, and especially a flavonoid that you're getting in the grapefruit called naringin. Narin, N-A-R-I-N, ginin, G-E-N-I-N. Naringin, and it helps burn fat out of the liver and cleanses the liver. And then one that's a little more challenging is garlic. But you can always take garlic and put it in a juice because you're getting the sulfur, and the sulfur is a great natural chelator, especially the allicin. And the allicin and selenium are very powerful detoxification agents for the liver. And then, of course, walnuts, turmeric, and avocados. And you can actually make a salad and blend those and put them in to the salad, but make sure you use those as well. So that is important. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us.
Are you tired sometimes?
I get tired.
Do things make you angry?
I'm angry at things.
Do you have things that make your thing feel that way that you don't like?
I'm confused.
Then surrender your will to Nosolitol, the multi-purpose pharmaceutical solution that Jesus raves about in the Bible.
Yay, Nosolitol for all.
Kids not getting all A's and meeting expectations for you to vicariously live through?
Give up.
And let drugs make it all better.
Yeah,
Nosolitol. Achy joints?
No problem.
Runny nose?
Annihilate.
Acid reflux?
Never again.
NASCAR fatigue?
Left turns rock.
Give in and allow the military-industrial complex company to eradicate the parts of your brain that they don't like.
Rational thought has to go. Thanks, Nosolitol.
I'm a real doctor, not an actor playing a doctor, and I recommend Nosolitol to all humans living and dead. I promise it won't chemically lobotomize you. I swear. Seriously, trust me. At least trust the white lab coat.
Bow down.
Nosolitol not only changes your mind chemically and inspires military service, but it comes in cherry, lemon, and our newest flavor,
socialist strawberry.
Tasty.
You want to have a better life.
Get your credit card.
You need our patented ingredients.
It's kind of like magic.
You get a 30-day money-back guarantee.
I was hooked in minutes.
You've tried ginseng, caffeine, and crack. Now let modern science show you how far they've come since Nazi Germany. No soul at all cures hangovers,
menopause,
hunger pains,
arthritis,
overthinking, dissidence,
flu symptoms,
diaper rash,
boredom,
hyperactivity,
erectile dysfunction,
sobriety,
restless leg syndrome,
it's a real disease,
angry in-laws disorder,
long-term memory retention,
and much, much more.
All because
you don't care anymore.
I like the pretty lights.
With no soul at all, you won't feel anything but synthetic love.
You want to feel the warming embrace of no soul at all.
You need to taste the sweetest berry on the bush.
No soul at all.
You get the euphoric feeling of having no critical thinking tools of your own at all.
Let your inner child soar into oblivion with no soul at all.
It is hip and also cool.
Don't stand out.
All the cool kids are doing no soul at all.
Side effects may include insomnia, dry mouth, stomach cramps, liquid-based bowel movements,
night terrors,
itchy rash, violent death, scratchy throat, hyperdiarrhea, rigor mortis, headache, dwarfism, giantism, hot flashes, heart attack, leprosy, and dissociative identity disorder. It should not be used by any carbon-based creature.
It's really, really safe.
I promise.
Order your first dose of No Soul at All today.
Get some.
Order now and receive a free gift.
It's convenient. No soul at all, too.
Yeah, life used to suck over here. Then I got no soul at all, and now I feel a lot better, you know?
Who needs God now?
Order now, or your life will suck.
Get some today.
Yay, no soul at all.
Solidol has been evaluated and approved by the FDA, meaning in all likelihood these pills will kill you. Use at your own risk. Welcome to the New World Order.
My guest joining us now is Dr. Philip Sanatkin. I believe I'm pronouncing it correct. If not, he'll tell us what it is. He is a practicing clinical psychiatrist, board certified in psychiatry and addictive psychiatry. He's worked in numerous mental health settings for nearly 30 years. Earned his master's degree in humanistic psychology from West Georgia College, and then a medical degree from Boston University. He is the author of 4 books and numerous journal articles on topics ranging from postmodern philosophy to eating disorders. He's a member of the Association for the Advancement of Philosophy and Psychiatry and Society of Existential and Philosophy. His most recent book is Psychiatry Land. How to protect yourself from pill-pushing psychiatrists and develop a personal plan for optimal mental health. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's Sanatkin.
Sanatkin.
How you pronounce it. Tough name.
Thank you. I'd like to begin first with what you would consider challengeable within psychiatry and psychology, for that matter. Are these objective sciences, and how prevalent is this? What I would personally consider is the psychiatric community's obsession that whatever they're coming up with in the way of a diagnosis and a treatment must be real and scientific, or otherwise it wouldn't have been accepted and approved and paid for by insurance companies. Please take us through this to determine, from your perspective, what you consider the pure science or possibly the myths.
Well, I would start by answering very definitively that psychiatry is not a science. It lacks the core fundamental property of a science, which is that the hypotheses in that science are potentially able to be disproven. And I'll give you a very simple example that I use in my book, which is a child who's acting up in school is taken to a psychologist, and the psychologist says, your child has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and needs to be on medication to control her behavior. You decide, I'm not happy with just one opinion, I'm going to go to another professional. You go to a board certified child psychiatrist who tells you, well, I know that the previous doctor diagnosed attention deficit disorder, but we're learning that many, many children who present with these symptoms are really bipolar and they suffer from bipolar disorder, which has very serious consequences, and treatment should be begun immediately, and there is going to be a lot of long-term problems if you don't treat her. And then you go to a systems-oriented psychologist who tells you, no, this is not ADHD, and this is not bipolar disorder. This is family dysfunction. It needs to be treated with family therapy. So there you have what are basically 3 hypotheses. Sounds very scientific. What's lacking is the ability to disprove any of them as true. you would, I think, very rightfully go to the doctor and say, well, I've gotten three different opinions about what's wrong with my child. Now, before I do something and actually put chemicals into her body or initiate some treatment plan, I would like some proof that she has this illness. And they'll say, well, we don't have any proof. Well, at least can you disprove that she has what the other doctor said? And when you lack that, then you lack the core essence of what is a science. And psychiatry lacks that.
It acts as if it has it.
You think they have it. They talk about the brain all the time. They talk about chemical imbalances. They throw around PET scans and MRIs. And yet there is absolutely no understanding at this time of any specific causal correlation between the action of neurons in the brain and the expression of emotional and behavioral problems. That's just the hardcore truth.
And why is it that you are one of only a handful of psychiatrists board certified with an academic background willing to discuss this? Why aren't the other, 40,000 psychiatrists willing to acknowledge this and go forward by adjusting the therapeutic model?
Well, it would be very hard to adjust the model, but it's more than that. It really encompasses all aspects of existence, including, very importantly, the economic aspect. I mean, I know psychiatrists personally, although I'm getting older now and there's fewer of us around, who might have been staunch psychoanalysts at one time, who now do nothing but prescribe medication. And like Willie Sutton, because that's where the money is, and I hate to be so shallow, but that is a harsh and true reality of our existence in this culture, that you have to make a living. And when insurance companies dictate the fact that we will only pay for a 15-minute medication check after your initial one-hour evaluation, then that's the service you provide, or you don't have anything reimbursable to do. But it's also more than that. It really has a lot to do with what is sometimes called the social construction of truth. See, I really am more a philosopher than a practitioner in my thinking, in my actions. I'm a practitioner, but I have spent my lifetime wondering about truth and reality and exploring that in the philosophical literature. And there's an entire dimension of philosophers that talk about the social construction of truth. So what we're really dealing with here is doctors who truly believe at the level of objective reality that psychiatry has progressed into a modern medical science. They're not being hypocrites. They're just pulled along with the tide of the social construction of truth. The reason I named my book Psychiatry Land was to draw attention to another phenomena where we all witness the social construction of truth, which is Disneyland. Probably the most skilled example of the social construction of a lived reality in our culture. That Disneyland is a magical kingdom, the happiest place on earth, where wishes and dreams come true. And we actually experience it that way, although in reality it's just an amusement park that's kind of crowded and hot and busy and tiring if you go there. But, we live it at that different level. So, it's gotten to the point now where we all kind of share in this socially constructed truth that psychiatry is a scientific enterprise that works with objective truth, because it uses the language of it. It uses the mechanics of science. It just is not a science, nor is science the answer to all of humans' problems and questions. See, that's the other shared reality we have, that ultimately all answers will come from science. But, of course, that's not true. Science is just one way of looking at things. I hope this isn't too confusing.
To the contrary, it's extremely clarifying, and I thank you for getting rid of the medical turbidity in the language that most couch it to protect their own interest.
Yes. Now
but by extension, then, if you would please, let's take this to the next level, and that is, if psychiatry is not a science, but we are told it is, And if they are now heavily promoting Teen Screen, and I believe it started with George Bush when he was governor, but then morphed into something now that has a whole national ALEC-based, and ALEC, of course, is the lobbying group of special corporate interests.
I think George called it the Freedom Council or something along those lines.
And now you have children asked to take a simple questionnaire, and we have actual examples of children, teenagers, who've taken the questionnaire, and one was actually taken to a mental institution against their the parents' will, and forcibly medicated and given electroconvulsive therapy, and was there for over 6 months. Why? Because of two questions and how it was interpreted. They said she had obsessive compulsive disorder because she liked to keep her room clean, and shyness disorder because she didn't like going to dances. She didn't like big crowded areas. Well, if we are able to agree as a society that only governmental scientists, and by extension then government mandate, that if you must take a mental competency test, everyone is supposed to. If you fail it or you don't get the answers that show you're normal, then you have no choice but to go under their medication regime. What does that mean? And how realistic is that to helping anybody except those people who are part of that profit center? Your thoughts, please.
Well, you know, first you have to define what you call help. It's amazing to me that when information is disseminated in this culture that it runs counter to the socially constructed truths, even when it's made available, it doesn't get utilized. For example, there has been a lot of information recently on major outlets such as the NBC Nightly News and in major newspapers that there's serious doubts about whether antidepressants have any benefit beyond placebo in mild to moderate depression. So you would think that that would penetrate somewhere into the brains of those people that are out in the world, and that the users of antidepressant medications might question their ongoing use, and also the providers might say, gee, well, maybe it's not so simple that, you know, a primary care doctor might say, maybe it's not so simple that every time a person walks into my office and starts crying, that I hand them a prescription for Zoloft, and that's the answer to the problem, and that's the proper thing to do. And yet that doesn't happen, because now we're dealing with power. We're not dealing with just belief. We're now dealing with the impact on belief of power, or as Foucault, one of the philosophers that I really appreciate, has said, knowledge, that power runs knowledge. So now we're talking about the same things I was listening to when I was on hold, the government in bed with the pharmaceutical industry, because what this all boils down to in the end is creating a customer base. I hate to say it. It just sounds so shallow and dystopian, but you know, these screening tests are to maintain a customer base, or to actually create a customer base. And as my friend Martha Rosenberg points out, we're doing it now with children so that we can have customers for life. So it's frightening, and now we're getting to the point where it might require some sort of social rebellion against instruments like Teen Screen before that can be changed.
There's one more
challenges
point.
In court, et cetera, you know, those kind of things.
Unfortunately, that doesn't always work because the judge is frequently limited in his own court or her court by acknowledging that the sole legal arbiter is the psychiatrist or the person from the mental institution, and which means anyone else trying to prove that they are not insane or don't need this care has an enormous obstacle to overcome.
But there are people arguing the other side. I mean, if I was the only person that saw this, I would think that I was, you know, certifiable and should be put away. But there's thousands of brilliant minds in this world that see this, that argue it. There's many books. There's many authors. These organizations you mentioned, like the Association for the Advancement of Philosophy and Psychiatry, another one called the ISEPP, are organizations of people committed to fighting this direction that psychiatry is going. And, you know, it isn't a singular voice, and you can mount arguments in court, as a group called Mind Freedom has done, But you got to be careful about your arguments. I mean, you know, it can't always be like our politics in this country, extreme left versus extreme right. You know, you can't argue against the, you just can't go in there and argue that there's no such thing as mental illness, and the other side is arguing that mental illness is a true physical disease, and then you just clash and nothing is accomplished. I have to say, and I'm not trying to promote the book, because but in psychiatry land, I try to find that middle ground where you actually can utilize the good that's going on in biological psychiatry. It's not all useless or some sort of plot against people. It's an effort to help people, but it's gone way overboard, and that needs to be pulled back in, as do the people who argue there's no such thing as mental illness, because I would argue that's a pretty difficult position to sustain as well when we see such clear-cut and undeniable examples of the abnormality of human behavior around us. But, you know, you need to bring it to something into it called wisdom.
I agree.
Okay.
Let me give you a little example of this. I befriended, at the beginning of my career, individuals who just happened to be either psychoanalysts or psychiatrists. Alan Perlman, a Perlmutter, also Carmi Harari. Let me see who else back then. There were a couple who were well-known and were actually authors. And they were more humanistic. In fact, all of them were humanistic. Elaine Kahn, very humanistic. Now, either a psychiatrist or a psychologist, Alan Cott, for example, these individuals spent quality time sitting with a person trying to determine why they might be able to be, why they are reacting and why they're acting out in some way. And I must say that in a lot of the people who I knew who were seeing them, there was some measurable improvement. Today, it is rare for someone, a psychiatrist, to spend quality time sitting with someone and to try to find out what might be going on in the person's life. For example, we had someone whose kids had absolutely been diagnosed by three separate psychiatrists as suffering from ADD and ADHD in one of the cases. But when nothing was working and one of the kids was suicidal and one was not able to eat, and I saw them and I counseled them, did some simple tests and determined that they were both extremely hyper on caffeine, and no one had asked how much caffeine. One was taking 700 milligrams caffeine a day, the other over 600 milligrams. I'd like to see anyone pay attention and sit still when you're on 700 milligrams caffeine. Plus, they both stayed up late at night. They didn't get adequate sleep. They were having junk food meals. And the mother said, after they eat their sugar, they're bouncing off the walls. Did the doctor talk about their diet? Not at all. So once they got their diet cleaned up, and once they had their nutritional biochemistry rebalanced, guess what? They no longer had the symptoms that were manifesting as this. And yet this isn't even considered in the paradigms. So talk about for a moment, at least from your personal perspective and experience, those individuals who at one time were guiding people in the light of more humanistic and philosophically based ways of helping people who are having emotional problems, and today where it's more often than not a pharmaceutical approach.
Well, I mean, I just think there's a lot of factors at work, but I can actually point to something that people are probably not very aware of, and that's the training of our practitioners. That we no longer pursue the idea of the psychiatrist being more widely knowledgeable about philosophy, sociology, and even psychology. They don't even, you know, they're not even required anymore to learn the theories of psychology, which is what broadens your horizons and opens your mind up to other ways of thinking, you know, alternative explanations of what you're seeing in front of you, including nutritional, but it can also be familial. And, you know, let's just add things like there's a book called Riddle and Nation that argues that this epidemic of attention deficit disorder is really an epidemic of stimulation disorder, that there's just too much stimulation going on. And you put one of these kids that is used to, you know, the iPhone in one ear and the iPad in the hands and the television going on in the background and texting someone all at the same time, and put them in a quiet classroom and they're going to be bouncing off the walls, that they're stimulus deprived. So, you know, it's all a matter of creating practitioners who have a wide range of knowledge and a wide range of possibilities in their mind. And the narrowing down of this to these few diagnostic possibilities, including whatever they're going to come up with in DSM-5, is the limiting factor from the get-go. So you have these dilemmas that are created that, you know, the first thing that people are given is a diagnosis. And the diagnosis, everything flows from that. Prognosis, treatment, expectations. And, you know, the other more subtle things are that once you're diagnosed with something, the other people around you change their behavior towards you. It's kind of like in physics, you know, they say that if you observe something, it changes the behavior of it. Well, if you now believe that your spouse is bipolar because some doctor told you that after a 5-minute questionnaire, well, now your entire conceptualization of why your spouse acts the way that they do has changed. Your expectations have changed. Their world has changed right around them. I say in my book that it doesn't even matter if there's anything wrong with your brain anymore, that once you're diagnosed bipolar, at some level you become bipolar. You take up that script. So I think that, you know, we need to be thinking about the education of our practitioners, but, you know, I just don't know where you approach that. All the money for education comes from NIH, and it comes from the pharmaceutical companies, and although there's some undermining now of the pharmaceutical companies directly funding things, there's just all these back doors, just like in our politics, that you know, their influence will be felt. And will be manifested in all of the research in psychiatry. And there's, you know, I'm not sure what you do about it. This isn't about my job. I think is to, you know, really display the problem in all of its aspects, and then hopefully people can take up solutions. I do offer the solution that already exists in our culture. You don't have to go to a doctor if you're depressed. You can go other places. You can go to counselors first. All of us run to our doctors. And our doctors are going to act in very predictable ways. They're going to diagnose and treat. And how do you, as a primary care physician, see 50 patients a day? Well, you can only give each patient 10 minutes. So along with checking their blood pressure and their blood sugar, you're going to treat their emotional disturbance by writing a prescription. So it really is about consumers becoming more savvy. And I don't know how you do that for sure. Spread the word?
Yes, it is. And this kind of interview helps a lot of people. My last question, and if you could summarize this rather briefly, with many things we do in our lives that don't work out, we look at the consequences. We're now seeing a very high adverse reaction in psychiatric drugs. And you also have to look at, I went back 30 years, the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. Yep. We never had that in the top 20 causes of death in the past. Do you see this as because so many young people, young boys in particular, are being diagnosed and treated with these drugs and suicidal ideation and akathisia and other conditions are a side effect?
Well, I do see us putting medications into people's system that our understanding is they act in the central nervous system affecting neuronal activity. And beyond that, we don't know anything for sure. All we know is we're mucking with people's brains. And I think that should be reserved for the most dire cases. And instead, it's being used widely without any concern of consequences. It's terrifying. Let me tell you, we just got a warning a couple months ago about an antidepressant drug that's been used for 20 years that it can cause heart attacks. It took 20 years for that warning to emerge. We got a warning early 2000s about 2004, 2005, about a drug called Paxil that is associated with birth defects. It was approved in 1992. You know, this whole business of tardive dyskinesia, akathisia, dementia from antipsychotic medications is well known from the early generation of antipsychotics. But then the pharmaceutical companies come up with these so-called second generation or atypical antipsychotics, and it's as if everybody forgets. You know, Dan Rather was on Bill Maher last week, and Dan Rather said the most frightening thing about our country is its amnesia. We learned these lessons the first go-round with these drugs. So, you know, the drug companies come out with these revolutionary products that are going to revolutionize, and we just forget what happened the first time around. That in the long run, we saw a lot of evidence of damage. This is, of course, Robert Whitaker's argument in Anatomy of an Epidemic, and one in which he's been getting a lot of grief trying to prove that. I mean, you know, you go out there with these kind of points of view, and you're going to run into a lot of massive backlash.
We're aware of that, and that's all the more reason. Trust me, we're aware of that. But we really respect the fact that you've had the courage to stand up and hold a mirror to your own profession and say, let's take an honest look at what we have become.
Well, beyond that, I try to say, what can we do about it? And, you know, it hasn't received any attention. I'm not going to, like, cry over spilt milk, but I couldn't even find a publisher. I had to self-publish this book. It's just not on people's minds, you know. It's just I think it's gotten to the point that so much has been explored in terms of the negative side of market-based capitalism that people are exhausted with it. They just don't want to hear it anymore.
Well, this is really not about body politics. This is about our own personal sanctity.
Yeah. It's
and
more
knowing
important
that
in
if
a way.
if we have an emotional problem, if we have a mental problem, we should be able to trust that there will be individuals there who will look after us and try to help us without simply looking at what is in their own best interest or what they're indoctrinated to. And you've laid out a very compelling argument in psychiatry land. And the website is psychiatryland.com.
Yeah.
I thank you very much for your good work. We look, hopefully, the people in this audience who respond very favorably to important topics and guests as articulate as you, who put it out on the line. That's what
we
want.
Well, I appreciate it. And if they want the book, it's on Amazon. Okay? And thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it.
All the best to you.
Thank you.
And that was Dr. Philip Sinaikin, Sinaikin. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Today to do the commentary that I had written on our American Imperium and our future, that I will do tomorrow. Instead, I'd like to open the lines for people to call in and share their points of view on what my guest, who had an enormous amount of courage to go online, because mind you, he's board certified, he's an academic, he has all the credentials, and yet he is saying, this isn't a science. What we're doing is hurting people, not helping them. Let's turn this around. And now he's getting the blowback from that. There's going to be a lot of it because it's a $50 billion a year industry, and they're not about to have someone challenge that. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'd rather use this time hearing what's on your mind in our talkback segment. Now, before we go to our talkback segment, in a moment, our special of the week, we only have one per week. This week, it is something that everybody needs every day, and that's fiber. But not everybody gets the amount of fiber they need, nor the quality of fiber. So I've invented a fiber, and it's called Friendly Fiber. And these are all the different fibers I've brought together. And you're going to buy one, you're going to get one free, plus you're going to get a $40 video on detoxification and natural approach free. So you're getting an enormous savings Now, you're getting a $111 value for $34. How about that? That's a tremendous savings. You're saving $76 today. I'll give you the number to call in a second, but let me just tell you what's in my Friendly Fiber. First, I put in the Friendly Fiber the finest types of fiber imaginable, from flaxseed and psyllium and rice bran, apple fiber, lecithin, oat bran. I put in fibers from grapefruit, orange, pineapple, lemon, lime, cherry, watermelon, pear, mango, strawberry, papaya, tangerine, apricot, and cranberry, Jerusalem artichoke, vitamin C, ginger root, fennel seed, anise, and cinnamon. There's nothing like this anywhere. This is considered the finest detoxifying formula available. It is called Friendly Fiber. I believe everybody should have 1 teaspoon, which is in the container, at night before you go to bed, with some vitamin C. That's the best time to take it. So you're saving $76 today. It's only costing you $34, and all that money goes to this Progressive Radio Network. Call the following number to get your Friendly Fiber. You'll be calling 877-627-5065. I believe that's the right number. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. One other quick mention. We have been sold out for this, 1,000 seats sold out in a matter of minutes for this new premiere of my new really hard-hitting film coming out on June the 15th. If anybody in the audience knows they can't come, please call and surrender your seat for those who would like to come. All right? Please call and surrender your seat so that other people can come. Otherwise, we are packed to the gills. All right? Now, let's go into our studio and let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hey, Gary. What an amazing piece. Boy, you know, that gentleman just said things that people were probably thinking about for a long time, and it's great to have people that do have the courage to speak out like that, and I agree totally. You know, there was a time in my life where everything in my external world that gave me an illusion of security was falling away. I used to be a skater, the rink closed. I worked at a hospital, the division I was in closed. I ended a 5-year relationship. My grandfather passed away. I saw my parents completely break down. And all of a sudden, I felt like I had no security because I didn't understand that I was my security. And I didn't want to go to a psychiatrist. I went to a psychologist. And I walked in and I said, listen, you got 6 weeks to work with me. If you can't help me in 6 weeks, you can't help me. And in 6 weeks, we worked it out, and I realized that it's okay to not have things go our way. And I understood a lot better about what was happening in my life and what I can do to keep myself stable throughout it. I didn't have medications. And a psychiatrist would have told me I was clinically depressed because I was feeling loss. And they would have put me on medications because I know the drill. I was an administrator at the hospital. So there are things to help us when we're not feeling right and we don't have to get diagnosed. And amazing, just one of the best pieces. I loved that guest. I have a letter here, Carla from Albany. And she says, with all of the students that are graduating that can't pay off their student loans, it looks like there's going to be less and less people enrolling in colleges. And she's asking here, how do we ascertain who should have a higher education given the economic and political backdrop today?
Good question. I believe everyone should have an opportunity for an education, but at this particular time, based upon what a person has to go through and what the likelihood is having a gainful employment when they get out and therefore being able to dissipate their debt so it doesn't accumulate, so they don't end up in a educational debt peonage system that is very punitive, I believe we have to stop for a moment and ask, what am I going to college for? Then look at the 50% of the college graduates who don't have work and are living at home, but have the debt, and the debt is frequently co-signed by their parents, which is an additional stress on the parents. So there are some fields that you must have an advanced degree or college degree or you're not going to have any work. And there are others I would suggest not to go to college. You'd be much better off developing crafts and skills that you can barter and exchange and fair market exchange. You'd be far more likely to survive. Now, for the ones who need a college degree, business administration. That's definitely because that's where you excel in leadership, engineering, computer sciences, accounting, and economics, though I see economics as being the weakest of those. I also would suggest registered nurses and healthcare. There's going to be a booming healthcare business out there. Education mainly K through 12. I also have things like a petroleum engineer. You're going to be well paid, and there's more demand than there are employees. Chemical engineering, mining and mineral engineering, computer engineering, electrical engineering, and all of those are well paying, and there's great demand, and you need an education for that, college education. And there are room for math teachers, science teachers, and bilingual education, which is going to be the highest game within teaching. I would also suggest environmental engineers, pharmacists, but you look at truck drivers. Truck drivers are one of the largest occupations out there, and you don't need a college education for that. You need skills and you need schooling, but not a college education. Customer service. We're going to have more and more people as customer service in the United States. You don't need a college education for that. Biomedical engineering. You not requiring a college education. Network systems and communication data, you don't need a college education for that. Home health aides, with 90 million people over 47 years of age and more getting sick, you're going to need to look in that. That's going to be lucrative and a lot of jobs opening up, and you don't need a college education for that. And also personal and home care aides. Remember, there are a lot of people, 70 million Americans, who are wealthy and, or at least are economically stable, and they're going to have people they're going to hire to be personal assistants, their own health chefs. I've gotten two friends of mine, jobs as chefs for people. Now they're making about $60 an hour helping people. There'll be more and more people as physician assistants. And that does not require a college education. Skin care specialist. All you have to do is have a certificate in skin care. You don't have to go to college, but you do have to go to a vocational school. Again, that's not that expensive, and don't take out their loans because they're going to charge you compounding interest. Physical therapists, there will always be an ongoing need for those. And dental hygienist, that'll be big. Veterinary technologies and technicians, some of those you don't require college educations. Others you do. You require special training, but that's not a 4 or 6 year background. Like a dental assistant is not a 6 year background. And medical assistants, especially in small practices, to help with take care of administration and clinical duties. That's a good area. So those are the areas that that I see that you would have to, of course, physicians, yes, where you'd have to have your college education. But a lot of places you don't. Like I see a booming business for electricians, masons, specialists, but not going where the building booms have historically been. You have people who are living in those areas who have carpentry skills or plumbing skills. They have to get themselves into municipal governments where they'll at least be working on infrastructure projects, helping to rebuild and repair bridges, buildings, tunnels, highways, dams. Those I see as being practical. I think that today you should think long and hard before you would go in to get one of the most important rounding degrees, which is liberal arts. I believe that philosophy and history and geology and government, those are all important to learn. But if it means $25,000 to $27,000 and not having a job, because there's no jobs out there for that, then someone's going to have to pay for that, and it's not going to be you, but the interest is going to start clicking into high gear once you're out of school, and your parents are going to pay for it. So where are you going to work? You're going to end up as a bartender? So I wouldn't do anything that didn't have some idea that I would have the skills necessary to compete immediately in the workforce. Otherwise, I believe that probably half the people going to college at this time should defer that and go into technical training that historically that was looked down upon. Oh, you're one of those, you know. Well, hey, if someone's out there right now, I can tell you this. If you are a an air conditioning repair and service person in Florida, you're making as much as most medical doctors, and you have more work than what you can do. So how stupid was it, you know, for them? It wasn't. It was the right choice. So then you should also align your choices by your own personality and your nature. Hope that answers the question.
Yes, it does. I just have one more quick announcement. As many of you know, I've been collecting calls for the sleepaway, and we were pretty much full. I did have one person who canceled yesterday, so if anyone is interested in coming down to the retreat, please do give me a call at 631-504-6198, 631-504-6198, or drop me an email, whnn@aol.com.
Thanks a lot. I'm Gary Knoll. That wraps today's program. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a good day.